Family Room Podcast, where I, Peter Squires, get to know your friends and neighbors. My family, they never knew. My family, they never knew.
My family. Welcome to the Family Room Podcast, getting to know your friends and neighbors. I'm Peter Squires. My guest on this episode is Joe Watts. Joe is the CEO of Star Island Corporation, which he has worked for since he was 16 years old. Joe and I discussed being a Pelican, or Pell, which is what we call the island's mostly college-aged summer staff, finding communities that fit your personality, raising kids in the smartphone era, the risks and rewards of world travel, and of course, role-playing games, among other things. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
How long have we known each other?
That's a good. That's a great question, actually. I'm trying to remember if I recall you when you're a Comfrey. I'm not sure I do.
Probably not.
I do recall from when you were a Pell, which was when? Around.
I started in 2003.
Yeah.
So. And then I worked in the wastewater treatment end of season 2004. So I think that was our first time really kind of like actually working together.
Yeah, 13, 14 years.
That's crazy.
That's a long time.
I know.
Yeah, time flies too.
Whenever I go back out to Star now as a conferee, I don't like thinking that I am no longer a Pell. You know, I don't like thinking that I'm no longer like a peer of the youth, but I'm certainly not. And I remember being a Pell and thinking how old 30 sounded, never mind 35, you know, and my last summer working out there in 2010 at 28, feeling old.
Right.
But still when I go out, it makes me sad to think like, oh yeah, I'm not one of them anymore.
Right. I've had a similar experience. Although it's been continuous. So,
right.
It's funny now, when I was hired for my current role, I think I represented the next generation, sort of young group coming in. And I found that very funny because the Pells, I've now crossed to the level where I am the age of parents of Pells.
Right.
But I don't know that. I still feel kind of silly about it. So basically, you know, in general, in life, so it's weird to pause every once in a while and think of yourself as the parent of somebody right. that you not quite think. I sort of think of myself as a Pell still.
Yeah.
So, but I'm so out of touch with that without knowing it.
Well, and you never stopped working at Star Island, right?
That's correct. That's true. So it's a little different. Although as you know, being a Pelican is an awesome, wonderful experience. And then when you get into management, it's still fun, junior management, but it's different. It becomes much more of a job, still of the place, still of the people, but eventually you're not socializing in the same way.
It's not all summer magic.
No, it's not. I mean, there were times where, you know, I was really looking forward to getting off the island. It's not because I didn't love the island. It's just that it's pretty intense.
Yeah.
You know, when you're a Pell, as you know, it's fun. It's creative. The work is important. You can get into that, but most of it's living there, being with your friends and in community. You know, you played all sorts of music, whatever you do, and you do it more intensely there. And that does suffer a bit when you're in management. And so I found that, but these days I find it less actually because what's happened, I've come full circle because I started as a conferee like you did.
Right.
And so when I eventually, like basically now every week I have good friends come out as part of the conference.
Yeah.
There's not a week that goes by where, so I have this built in sort of, social life that's really enjoyable. And because I'm not on the radio, I'm not the island manager anymore.
Right.
The job com, which people thought I would never be excited
never
to leave
really
behind,
wish.
But the moment I left it behind, secretly I was excited.
Are you sure you don't have like a police scanner or something on your desk so that you can just like have a little know what's going
on? No, I don't mind. I don't mind people thinking that or wondering if I do, but I really don't. And I used to, the worst part of the job or one of them was actually having that radio on at night. And then because of the potential that something could happen, which usually didn't.
Right.
But, you know, somebody had a heart attack.
But when it did, you knew it was a big deal.
Right. So you have this radio on the whole time. And then, and so as soon as that stopped, I slept better. I enjoyed the island more.
Yeah.
I was less eager to, like this summer, I'd stay on island for some of my days off so that my kids could be in the youth program.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So anyway.
That's really nice. How many years have you been CEO now?
I have been CEO. This will be my, this is my fifth year. I started in 2012 officially. So not quite 5 years, but five summers. It was known that I was going to be CEO. So it was a long transition period.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's just starting to feel, comfortable. I probably shouldn't say that, but
no,
but
no.
It's true.
It makes sense. That especially when like, the year round duties and the on-island duties are so distinct, and that the conference season only lasts, you know, 3 or 4 months, that it would take a couple of years worth of those months to add up to feeling like you have a full, complete grasp of everything that happens and should happen.
Absolutely. And I think shifting roles, it was obviously easier for me having grown up in Star and been in a lot of different jobs. So I had relationships with people,
yeah,
which is probably one of the hardest things for a new CEO to form at any, wherever they go.
Right? Yeah.
You have to, you know, with not just with the staff, but everybody, all the customers, as you call them, I suppose, in other businesses. And so I had that going for me. But shifting gears from one job to the other was hard because I moved from operations to non-operations.
Right.
You know, it wasn't just hard for me. But we did it pretty well. And I think it took a little while on that front. But there's always a special thing going on. There's always some project or some unique thing or more than one in any given year. So, you know, when we were putting in the solar project, that was like a 2.5 year project on top of everything else. So there's always that too, but no, it feels good right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even know what that would look like to have, just sort of a normal summer without some big thing also underlying it, you know, like, or and will that ever happen again? That Star Island is just sort of having a, like a standard year where there isn't, well, the good thing is those projects in several years haven't felt like emergencies, at least from the less involved perspective. So that's probably a good thing, that it's like, oh my God, this is the proverbial fire we need to put out, in terms of some things breaking, something's been mandated, et cetera. Now it's like, it feels more like these are projects that we're choosing to take on in order to make the island better. But it's like, so I wonder what it would even look like to land on just sort of like, all right, we're good where we're at for a minute.
Right. You know, right. I guess a very small part of me would like that break, but
yeah.
I think that would be, that would be boring and wouldn't be good for Star. Like, you're right.
Yeah,
we're on a streak where things are going well.
Yeah.
Streak's not even the right word. We're on a sustained positive, increase in how things are going. And I feel that all these sort of planned, as you said, projects or initiatives that we're taking on are good for Star Island and hopefully good for beyond Star Island.
Yeah.
And so I would never want them to stop.
Yeah.
There always is the potential for something to go wrong.
Yes.
And you know, from time to time, some things do go wrong. So the job's never boring. And not just the CEO role. I mean,
you know,
as you know, just being out there in general, any role, all the roles matter. And they're never, generally, they're not boring.
Yeah.
I suppose there's some repetition for certain jobs like Waitry or whatever.
Yeah. I don't know. I was a bad bellhop.
Bellhop.
I only ever bellhopped as a rounder, so I wasn't ever fully like in the swing of things. Mm. And bellhop's not boring. I was just bad at it. Like,
wow.
It was like, oh, you can wander around with the job com and like make yourself busy. Okay.
Right. You're probably good with people that came to the desk.
Yeah.
And all of our jobs or most of them are seasonal anyway. So, you know, by the time All-Star 1 starts, the largest conference, these veterans have like 2-3 weeks in their, under their belt, which the people at All-Star 1 don't know about, but that's the way it is. So.
That's one of the fun parts I've found, or sort of interesting, unique parts about Yak, is that it's the first conference of the summer, and the staff arrives, most of the staff arrives while you're there. And so just seeing the waitry so nervous to like wait on a table for the very first time. And I remember feeling that way. Just sort of like, for a lot of them, it's probably their first job at all, you know? So not just sort of having to figure every single little detail out. And then by the end of the week, they kind of, you know, they start waiting on the staff and they start, you know, practicing more, and they already seem a little more comfortable. And time moves out there in such a funny way, you know, where a week can feel like forever, especially when that's all the time you have there. To watch that sort of progress right before your eyes is a really interesting dynamic.
Well, it's a great group, the young adults, or yearly adults. Is that right? What you're calling yearly adults.
We're not young anymore.
You're not young anymore. That group is a great group to have that sort of the training week happening. And yeah, you're right. People, and me too. I remember being an end of season waitry and being very nervous. And now when I'm sitting in the dining hall or in a waitry's at my table, and it's maybe the first time they've come to that table, I just, it's hard for me to remember that, in fact, I was having a discussion with a friend of mine saying, oh, well, that was because, you know, many years ago, the management was different, but like, they're not worried about me now at all. Like, how could they be?
Right.
And so he said, no, I'm sure they are. So we stopped and asked the waitress. It was like probably very uncomfortable.
Oh my God, I'm talking to my boss's boss right now.
She said, yeah, no, I think she was confident enough to say, yes, I'm uncomfortable, which was great. You know, and I was like, oh my God. It's similar to that, that thing about, you know, aging as a Pell, thinking that you're, because you are part of this, you always are part of being a Pell. And so you have these memories and, you know, what they say, there's no former Pell because you're always a Pell.
Right, yeah.
But I think you lose sight of this, the thing like when 30 used to seem so old, right? But like, it's a similar thing, you know, you get, so you have a sense of comfort and you can't imagine that these things now apply to you.
Right.
You know, but they do.
Yeah. I'm the pain in the ass conferee who keeps asking every time they come out with the other thing that I asked for, I keep asking for another thing for them to bring out.
Well, and you know, sometimes the group of Pells run the gamut, but some of the hardest critics without even knowing it, of the current Pells are people who used to be Pells.
That makes sense.
Is what it was when they were a Pell, you know, this X, Y, Z. So,
and I guess I just always wanted to think that, the Pells that came after me, that me and my friends would somehow be this like legendary group of Pells that were remembered thereafter. And that ends up being true for about a year while some of your friends are still there. And then you're just completely forgotten to history.
I agree. And though you'll always remain the legendary group of Pells to yourselves.
To ourselves.
You know? And I think that's,
You know who we are? Kind of a big deal.
But it depends on your motivation. Like if you're looking for like street cred, then no. But if it's part of your memory and the roots you formed with your friends, then it's always true. And that's part of what makes it special. So
the only reason I do anything, to be clear, is for street cred. So how old were you that summer you were an end of season waitress?
I was 16. So I was just finished. It was the summer between my junior and senior year of high school.
Wow. And that's not even a thing anymore, right?
No, we don't. No. Yeah. Justina as well. She was a 16. She was a full season 16-year-old.
Wow.
And I mean, so we no longer hire under 18. Yeah. I know from personal experience why that's not the greatest plan. And, you know, we can legally do it, but it's just because of the living away from home, the community living. And as you say, it in many people's case, their first job. So if it's also their first time away from home, it's a challenge. So we've done 18 and up. But the average age of the Pells has gone up over time. No question about it. Since I was a Pell. And, you know, I think we still have challenges finding people to work in the season. Mm-hmm. And so it's tempting to think about 16-year-olds, but, you know, they have to, if we would ever consider it, it'd have to be somebody who could make a meaningful, positive contribution to the community. And I don't know how many 16-year-olds are in that position.
Yeah.
But nothing's impossible, I suppose.
Yeah. And there's a huge difference. There's such a bigger difference between age 16 and 19 mm-hmm. than there is between age 19 and 22. You know, like, that's a lot. Those are big years.
I agree. Even forget 16, even 17, 18-year-old high school grads.
Yeah.
You know, they've been living at home. They go off, whether they go to college or whatever they do. If they, once they have some time out on their own doing something, you know, and then the following summer they apply to STAR, much better, much better for everybody involved. Most importantly, the people who are 19. It's a generalization. And certainly when I was a young pal, cause in my first full summer, I was 17. And I just graduated again. It was before, other than STAR, I hadn't been away from home.
Right.
And, it was very formative and I learned a lot. It was great. I was a very supportive community. I was much more prepared to be in college, because of my time on the island. So it's not, you know, it's not that, it's just a different day and age.
Yeah. I had sort of an unusual trajectory because my first summer as a Pell, I had just graduated from college. And I don't want to say I didn't like college, but I didn't like college as much as I perceive other people to have liked college. Mm. And, socially, STAR working as a Pell was more like my Pelican friends ended up being in my life what most people's college friends are in theirs, you know, but I also think it was different to have that, experience starting a little older, to not have to like learn everything for the first time, mm-hmm. you know, to have, to be of age for one thing, you mm-hmm. know, to sort of like be able, you know, we were still insane, but we were less, baby faced, I guess.
Right.
We meaning me and a couple of other people who were also older, quote unquote, for first year Pells. I'm not going anywhere with that, but I'm just thinking about how much different my experience would have been if I had started like while I was in college rather than afterwards. Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because when you started sharing that, I was about to say, oh, I feel the same way. That's all, you know, my college wasn't all that I thought it would be. Mm. whereas, I mean, there are a couple of exceptions, some friends, but overall, the social experience that I had throughout college was when I was a Pell.
Right.
And not only those summers, but then visits to people, mm-hmm. you know, to visit them. I went to school in Philadelphia, I go to New York, or I go down to Maryland and, you know, go on trips on weekends. And that was my social life. So that's how I started when you were saying that. But then you're right. You came in at the end of this time and I came at the beginning. And so there's a common thread, but I definitely grew. My college experience was happening sort of as a side issue to my Pelican life.
A thing you had to get done between summers on summer. Yeah. Where did you go to college?
I went to University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia.
Heard of it.
It was good overall. Actually, you know what? I didn't like it. But my highlight was going to England for a year. My junior year abroad. And that was through, I suppose, indirectly, it was through Penn. So, and then when I came back after that and was able to focus really just exclusively on my major, which was English literature, I enjoyed it. I went to grad school there for a little, basically. So the end part of it was okay. But it was really academic. It wasn't social. We were talking socially.
Yeah.
I didn't find much of a social life there.
Yeah. I had a harder time making friends in college than anywhere else.
And where did you go?
Vassar. I had a lot of friends in high school. I went to college and I had friends, but there was, even while I was there, there was this feeling that like somehow we weren't sticking quite the same way. And then the summer between my junior and senior year of college, I went and lived with my two best friends from high school. One went to Brown and one went to RISD. So I went and lived with them for the summer in Providence.
It's a good town.
I immediately made a bunch of friends. And I was like, okay, it's not me. I didn't just become antisocial. There's some fit problem between me and Vassar. And by that point, I was like, well, I'm not going to transfer. I have 1 year left.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went out to Star and made a bunch of friends. And it was like, okay, so now I can, you know, that was fine. And I have a degree, but it wasn't. It was sort of a good learning experience to feel what it felt like to not have the right fit socially.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And to know that it can be avoided. You don't just have to grin and bear it.
Right. And that some choices you make in life are, you know, maybe don't go against conventional wisdom. You know, where do you, you know, do you find a job and then move to that place, or do you move to the place that you want to be and, you know, where you want to be and then find a job? And that's in my, I remember, you know, that's very simplistic, but the old guard wisdom was to get your job and then go there.
Wherever it is.
I refused to do that.
Yeah.
I wanted to move to where I wanted to be and then have things work out. And they did. They did.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's such a big part of choosing where you want to be is that idea of fit. You know, that like this place just feels like home. In one of my previous conversations was with Shannon from Maine Meat Butcher Shop. And she was talking about how she grew up she spent a lot of time in Florida, but had always just had this like calling to New England for her whole life, even though she hadn't spent much time here. She just sort of knew. And I thought that was really interesting, that just sort of some people are just meant to fit somewhere.
Yeah. And I think and great if you can find out where that place is.
Yeah.
And then also be able to move there.
Yeah.
And, you know, try it out. So it can be a risk, right? Because you don't really know.
Right.
You know, she's moving from Florida to New England because she feels this way, right?
And then you get here and it's a rude awakening.
Yeah. Well, but in her case, it sounds like it worked out nicely.
Yes.
And that's great. And people really should try to do that. And I don't mean to sound privileged. Some people can't, you know, it's like there's an affordability issue.
Of course.
And, you know, having said that, it's worth rolling the dice, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did you study in grad school?
I had initially English lit as well. So I got my master's at Penn. But then after a few years off, I wanted to be a teacher. So I went back and got my ed degree here at UNH.
Wow. So were you ever?
I was, yeah. See, Star Island was an accident.
Yeah.
Maybe. Maybe not. But I did. I was a high school English teacher for... which I didn't realize I wanted to be when I was in college, but after, you know, shortly thereafter, I thought it would make for a great job. And sure enough, after a pretty tough first year, I really only taught 3 years, a student teaching year, and then 2 years in Monadnock Regional High School, south of Keene, New Hampshire. So I lived in Keene. And the reason I left is my summer job at Star became year round.
Right.
And the manager said, hey, you know, well, we assume you won't take this, but, you know, we're making your position year round. If you want it, you can have it.
You know what they say about people who assume.
right. And so I figured that I could always go back to teaching and find a position somewhere, but that the Star Island thing was unique and I might as well try that out. And that was in 1998. So I haven't, maybe I will go back to teaching, although I don't know. I feel like I've forgotten a lot. Like, I'd be hard pressed to teach grammar.
It would be like riding a bike.
What are the parts of speech? I don't even know if that's relevant anymore. You know, I'm so out of it, but it was great. And really teaching was interesting because, you know, I got into it initially because I was like, oh, this is great literature. And, you know, it's poetry, inspire kids. And then I got in, it had nothing to do with that. And it was really, you know, first of all, it was what they call classroom management or like really behavioral issues. Mm-hmm. Like, and you're a young teacher. I was 26 and, you know, that I was teaching 10th, 11th and 12th grade. And I was in an area where at least the classes I was teaching, probably a minority of the students were going to go to college.
Right.
And so I remember shifting curriculum around to talk about resume write and cover letter writing, and you know, it was a lot different than what I thought going in. But it was by the time I left, it was very rewarding. I felt like I was making a difference, or at least I could see a pathway to making a difference. And so, you know, I could do that again. But I have no interest in moving on from Star.
But I think that it's the kind of thing that it's nice to have experience like that that you could return to. You know, it's the kind of thing where it's like, you know, if you were a pro wrestler or a like something really like physical, something that would require you to be a certain age or a certain ability, you know, that like you could be a teacher at any point in your life, you know. So and your experience since then, though not in a school, has probably sharpened the sort of classroom management piece of it in certain ways. You've been working with young people and getting to know their behavioral oddities in some like pretty more in-depth ways than you might in a classroom.
Well, absolutely. And I think also being a parent, and I know that sounds horrible. I remember being a single non-parent teacher and having parent teachers say like, oh, once you're a parent, you know, that was like one of my biggest pet peeves. Now that I have a 10 and 12 year old, I'm like, wow. Yeah, really. I have learned a lot about, like, if I had to teach a 12 year old now, I'd be much more prepared because of my daughter. So, you know, there's that and the work at Star Island. So who knows, maybe that's in the cards, but, as a retirement job. Although it's a busy job.
That doesn't sound... A retirement job sounds like something you do a few hours a week. And kind of relax.
Wrong term.
Anyway. A pre-retirement job.
Yeah. My wife's a school nurse, and she loves it. So, and this, you know, I can't... It's hard to say. I have my frame... My points of reference are when I was in high school, which I really didn't like. And then when I taught in high school... And then now with my kids, they're not quite in high school, but they're in middle school. And it's just the worlds of difference. But I don't know how much of it's time, how much of it's geography, you know, where you're, what the district is. But I'm really impressed with what I hear about and see at the school where my children attend. And also which is where my wife is a school nurse. So
oh, wow.
Kind of have the inside track.
Yeah, that must have... Do they have to deal with sharing a school? Like, oh God, mom's here.
I don't think so. Yes, except not. I don't. I think they kind of like it, whether they would admit to it or not. I think it's you know, it's an unusual school. It's a 4-8 school, and the fourth graders are segregated, but it's a very different model than what you would think of with a middle school.
Yeah,
and I think it's great. Well. I would imagine I'm biased, but an exceptional school nurse. So I don't think there's any mortification.
And the coolest school nurse.
Yeah, probably. So I don't think that there hasn't been any problem.
Yeah.
But they, except for the fact that they can't, you know, fake sick.
Right. It was like, I feel like there was, in every school I ever went to, there was always one or two kids who were the kid, probably more than one or two, the kid of a teacher at the school. And I always just thought like, man, that must stink. You know, that like people will talk about your parents behind your back or in front of your face, you know, and just, I just remember thinking like, man, that must have been so weird. My mom was an elementary school teacher. And when I have a sister who's 10 years younger than me. And when my sister was in elementary school, my mom taught the grade that my sister was in every year, but at a different school. So it was like when my sister was in first grade, my mom was in first grade. And so she could kind of like, she could be on top of whatever was going on in that year. Man, it's so funny. I just like, I never think about elementary school anymore or middle school, but it's so important.
I didn't either. Yeah. And I think what's happened is now that much to my kids' dismay and my wife's dismay, as my kids now that I have kids and they're growing through these things, I remember when I was in third grade, this happened. And I'm saying that all the time to them. And I think too much. is what I got. What I hear, the feedback I'm getting.
Dad, that was like in the 20s.
Why is this about yourself? That's all they're saying. But it's sort of true. And I, you know, but it does bring back memories, things I haven't thought of in, since then, you know, for whatever amount of years it is. I'm old enough to not be able to do the math as quickly as I, sorry, no event. I didn't mean that about age. I meant more that it's been, so probably almost 40 or 35 years, right, have passed, and I haven't thought of X thing until now because my son's going through it. And
it's funny to tell them, like, or to try to not tell them, like, oh, you're not going to have to know how to do that.
Right.
I'm doing fine, and I don't remember that at all.
Yeah. No, the two things I think. One is I remember thinking, like, the whole I would never do that if I were a parent. And, of course, I do those things. It's funny. But that's not nothing novel about that. The other thing is technology, just the difference culturally. I remember watching the original Star Trek reruns and, you know, things like the teleportation device or the, you know, the big screen with the, you know, the captain on the other ship, you know, whatever. Those things were complete science fiction.
Right.
And now we have one of the two of them.
Right.
And not only do we have it, but that, you know, it's normal.
Yeah.
Totally. And like people didn't know, like my kids don't know that doesn't really, I mean, I guess they kind of know that it used to not happen.
Yeah.
But. So I've used that example with them and say, so, you know, teleportation, the big view screen seemed just essentially as unlikely as the teleportation. And so I, you know, the fact that my daughter just got a phone, you know, which is like that she can carry around with her.
That must be kind of a freak out.
It was. I was kind of a holdout because I feel it's not so much them against the technology and there are certain benefits in ever since I learned to voice text this summer, I'm real excited. But, you know, I think it's just that once you're connected, your life changes. Mm. And I think one of the beautiful things about Star Island is that you have the opportunity to kind of get away from being connected.
Right.
And I think that's, those moments are few and far between these days. And I think that, so it's not my only be, it's not, it's not even the money. My wife got a great plan. It's not even, it's just that you're connected and you're looking at a screen.
Right.
And I want my kids, and they do, but I want them to continue to have good friendships that are real and not on screens.
Right.
And to the percentage of time should be, it's the same with video games. I'd rather play games,
right?
Play board games, role-playing games, et cetera. And then maybe every once in a while go to the screens, then the other way around. And I know I'm fighting a losing battle, probably at least statistically. So that was the only thing that freaked me out about her getting a phone was, does that somehow detract from the wonder and magic of her life?
Well, yeah, and that once you connect, the difficulty with disconnecting. I think that's a really fair and realistic concern, you know, because... You know, we're planning this big trip and I've been freaking out like, well, what are we going to do about our phones? Like, how are we going to have phone service? Like, how are we going to make this work? It's so expensive if you want to have it. And it's just like, or we could not use our phones quite so much, you know? And I've been having to kind of like adjust to the idea that we're going to have to use them in a very different way. And we might have to... And I'm glad to be thinking about that now, not only to sort of like emotionally cope with it, but also to like, we might have to prepare a little more because we're not going to be able to pull up directions to every single thing out of our pocket at a moment's notice. We won't just be able to research on the fly. They're not going to have internet flying through the air everywhere that we go. And even if they do, we may not have access to it. So, you know, we might have to sit down and look at a map and read a book.
You know? Well, there's something romantic about that. And hopefully it's as rewarding as it sounds, you know, like something, you know, this on-demand thing and you're going on this great trip. And part of the adventure you would hope is that you can't just immediately call up everything at you know, on a screen and that you're going to be able to, you know, maybe it's okay to have to be lost for a little bit or find a
map.
It's easy to say that
right
when you're living it might detract from the enjoyment.
But I mean, it's true. I mean, I can't really remember the last time that I got lost for that exact reason, you know, that like, oh shit, I have no idea where I am right now. Actually, I do. It was when we were in Puerto Rico and pre-smartphone, we had one of the Garmin GPS devices and we brought it with us. And it totally didn't work there. So it was like, turn right. And like, if we had turned right, we would have gone off a cliff kind of a thing. Oh, you know? So it's like, oh, we shouldn't be listening to this thing at all.
Well, it's a good thing you realize because you can, you can almost envision a cartoon where like somebody using their Garmin, it says turn right and there's a cliff, literally like one of those Far Side kind of cartoons. And I'm just worried enough people would turn right anyway,
you
know? Which is not good.
No. It's like there's a muscle that you're not exercising in terms of knowing almost like a orienteering for the modern age, you know, like I don't know where I am. How do I figure that out?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And especially at nighttime, it's
right.
Hard.
Right.
But you have to keep that active in your mind somehow.
Yep. Yeah. I think, you know, and I don't know much about this, but it came about in the connection with my daughter's phone. I think again, there's two ways to do it, right? One is just to disconnect, even if you don't have to find out where you are,
you know,
just to not be, it's the same thing I was saying with the JobCom at night, the radio and being, mm-hmm. you know, kind of like the just being connected influences you in your mindset, and it can be stressful, or it, you know, you're on, or you have some, you know, there's something going on where, so if you're literally disconnected, even if you don't have to find your way, that's good. And then I think your point about, you know, exercising this muscle, maybe it's not a bad thing to be able to find your way.
No, it's a great thing. It's a great thing. And it's a really scary thing to have that moment of feeling like you don't remember how,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, that disconnecting, it's important. And relating it to the JobCom is an interesting parallel. I remember actually this past summer on Star having that terrible feeling that I'd had before where you've taken your phone and your wallet and your keys and everything out of your pocket, which is like my favorite thing,
mm-hmm.
first thing
mm-hmm.
I do when I go to Star. And then sitting down to eat or something and feeling your leg vibrate. Even though your phone's not in your pocket, the like phantom buzzing, so disturbing.
Wow.
You know?
It's like withdrawal from their cell phone.
Yeah. Like something is triggering in my brain that is telling me like to pay attention, you know, but it's like, it's affecting our wiring in a way that's disconcerting.
No, I you know, I love Star and I'm connected year round. It's seasonal and yet year round,
mm-hmm.
you know, I've had that same buzzing going on even during this discussion.
Yeah.
You know? And I, having said that, when we went to Turkey 2 years ago, mm-hmm. and we went on an extended vacation, and there essentially, I mean, I could check email every once in a while. We were staying with family and, but I really was mostly disconnected, and it took like 10 days, but after a certain period, I didn't feel the need to actually go and check, you know, like, and then once that happened, it was really quick. It was like really sudden. And I just felt it was uplifting. And I came back totally re-energized. Mm. So I do think, so that's what I wish for my daughters. Like, okay, you have a phone. It's a tool just like anything else. It's great. I mean, she was asked, are there 2 R's in transferred? And I was like, well, can you look it up? Of course you can. You have a phone.
Yeah, right.
It's so much easier than
a computer
in
your pocket now. Yeah.
So the point is that it's a tool that can be used well. But what we're talking about is like not letting it become something that negatively impacts your life without you even knowing it.
Right.
And I just feel that it touches so many people in a negative way, but
yeah,
I don't mean to sound like an anti-technology.
No, person. I mean, I think that both can be true at the same time,
right.
That it is useful and revolutionary and a huge technological moment. This sort of like before and after not only the internet, but mobile access. But and also that there are these clear detriments to it as well. What was Turkey like? Because I, that was one of the places that I most wanted to go on our trip, and it just doesn't, it's just not a good time to do that.
Right. No, the, well, we went just before, you know, the, Turkey's been the news a lot, as you know. And, first of all, Turkey was amazing.
Yeah.
It's hard to truly evaluate because we were staying with family, Brenda's nephew, who's our age, his wife and their three kids. And we all get along. The kids get along. The parents get along. They're from the UK, from Wales, but they've been living in Turkey for 10 years. So they met us there. They speak Turkish, you know, they know where to go. So like we were like escorted by essentially Turkish people and we stayed at their, we were in Istanbul for only 4 days. We were there for New Year's Eve, New Year's Day in 2014 to 15, I think it was. And then we went to their house, which is much more rural, sort of far away from Istanbul. And basically, it was amazing. It was the only place I've ever been where Call to Prayer would come out, you know, it's like in the, and it was like, so you're just, and it took a while to get used to, but, you just hear like, whatever, you know, and it happens like five times a day or whatever it is.
Right.
And it's just, it really made me feel like I was in a totally a different place than, and I've traveled around Europe and I've traveled another, certainly a lot around the United States, but this was entirely different. Well, at the same time, I felt safe the entire time. The people were incredibly friendly. The only time I didn't feel comfortable was when we went to, which is one of the biggest tourist sites, is the Grand Bazaar. And like people try to haggle and they're just trying to like get you to buy stuff. And it's just awkward. But other than that, I felt it was great. And the sites were amazing. And they're, you know, you can right in Istanbul, there's this one area where you can walk to these amazing, you know, places and do them all, you know, in a day. And I don't like brushing over like quote unquote tourist sites. They're tourist sites worth seeing.
Right. Yeah.
We also went at a time when there weren't a lot of crowds and, you know, we saw this like 6.5 foot long great sword, which was pretty awesome. And then we went down to, and also we went where they live near the Ephesus and we went there again when there weren't many tourists. So we almost had the place to ourselves. And, so it was amazing and it's really sad to see that, you know, all the troubles that they've been having. And at first, you know, our relatives stayed with us last summer. They were here. And that was during the coup d'etat. And that was during the airport bombing, actually.
Wow.
So right after they left the airport, like 2 days later.
Wow.
And at first they were, and they still are. I mean, they're very, they think that the Western media sort of blows things out of proportion.
Mm-hmm.
But it just seems like now there's just more and more, they have this internal thing going. I'm not going to get into Turkish politics,
no.
Mostly because I don't know enough about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, the PKK is it's sort of internal thing going on. And then now ISIS, it's just like, oh, you know, so I wouldn't go there now, even knowing the family and even though they'll maintain it safe. And it probably is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's probably as safe there as some places you could go here in the United States, to be honest.
But right.
Having said that, we're also planning a trip coming up as a family and we're traveling with them, but we will not be traveling in Turkey.
Where are you going to go?
Well, that's the adventure, right? We without device, really, we're going to be deferring a lot to them because they travel, but we're mostly going to focus in Central Europe, Central and Eastern Europe, places that our family wouldn't normally go, like just on a family vacation,
right.
Because these folks travel all over the place. They've been all over the world and they do low budget trips and they tent out. And so we'll probably spend most of our time in Romania and Hungary and possibly Southern Poland. You know, that those kinds of places.
Yeah.
I can't say Czechoslovakia. Czech Republic.
Right.
You know, Czech Republic, you know, places like that is where I think we're going to spend most of our time.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
We're going to spend a little bit of time. We're sort of starting our train travel in Budapest. And then I think the farthest east we're going is Krakow. And I want to visit Auschwitz.
Mm.
But I was just looking the other day at the map on my phone and I realized that sort of like longitudinal line around that part of the country is very confusing to me. Like, oh, I don't know where anything is.
Uh-huh.
I think I was looking up where's Armenia.
Right.
And then it was like, oh yeah, this whole section where like Western Europe meets Eastern Europe and where the Middle East kind of begins. It's all very blurry to me. Like I could never actually pinpoint where anything is. So just sort of spending a little bit of time figuring that out was mm-hmm. an interesting exercise.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. It's a confusing area, especially if you haven't traveled around there in the area. And we have the, however, I think it's fairly compact. One of the things I gather is that in Budapest is one of Thomas, the oldest child is, or one of the two twins says that's his favorite place he's ever been. So,
wow.
You know, and, you know, I also hope to go to Krakow and that area in Auschwitz and see that, but I think I want to.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you're not like, oh, I'm so excited to go there.
Right, just... right. And, you know, and then you think about, do you bring your 10, 12-year-old? Probably, yes, you do. And then what do you talk about, you know?
Yeah.
But outside of all that, it's like there's a lot that you can go and do in that area. But I think we have the luxury of this family. They really are expert travelers, and they do this every other summer. So we're just kind of, and they know where to go. Like there's this amazing ropes course in Romania, and they just go and camp by some lake and go to the ropes course for three days. And it's like, it's huge. It's like 10 times bigger.
You're like, whatever, we can do that in Kittery.
Yeah. Yeah. Fine. Well, but it's yeah. Like the one at Kittery, sure. I'm sure it's great, but this is, it's apparently much bigger and cheaper. That's the other thing.
You know,
they are budget people. They live on $10 a day.
Family, all year long?
Family of five. Not when they're traveling, but at home.
Wow.
I know that sounds crazy and we probably shouldn't get into it, but
that's amazing.
They pull it out. It's a combination of things. You know, there's no restaurants. There's no, you know, they prepare all their food, the exchange rate, you know, et cetera. They already own their house, but, you know, it's just, it's a wholly different thing. So when they were living here, it was a really interesting, we get along and have so much in common with that family. And yet the differences between what they look at when they go to the store, what they'll buy, what they quote unquote need, you know, versus what we, I should say, quote unquote need.
They must see your fairly average American family life as extravagant.
Yeah. But they're not judgmental
right,
at all.
Yeah.
An interesting example is, you know, Brenda in particular, and I support it, will buy organic, fruits and vegetables and,
right.
you know, trying to buy like nice whole grain thing, you know, and mm-hmm. they're like, they're buying the bargain brand when they're on sale, bargain brand things.
Right, yeah.
And they just don't, they're like, without saying it, they just think it's ridiculous that we would buy organic. So
yeah.
Why would you spend five times as much on, you know, compared to what I can get,
right,
you know,
yeah.
over here. And so that was really interesting to see and to hear. And I think we both probably wore off a little bit on each other.
Yeah.
In good ways, I would hope. Yeah. So
don't buy the hype. Don't buy the marketing. Don't buy with the media story, etc. Mm. Oh, that's very interesting. I hope they're right about Western media over sensationalizing things, because I'm starting to get nervous about our trip to Egypt. And you know, I've always been nervous about our trip to Egypt, but sort of determined like, well, it's, you know, there's risk everywhere, and it's worth it, and the odds are in your favor. But there was just another sort of a re-alert from the State Department, because there was another series of attacks there, and there was, you know, one in Cairo and one in Giza where the pyramids are, and it's just like, you know, and I'm having a hard time figuring out how to make that. How to appropriately balance my risk and reward meter, you know?
Yeah, and I don't have an answer for that. I know I did use, when we were going to go to Turkey, we looked in the State Department website,
mm-hmm.
and at that time, the the biggest risk was some con where they get you to try to buy fish and then you have to pay an exorbitant amount. You know, right. It's like that was the oh, yeah. And by the way, the driving is horrible. So you always have to pay attention as a pedestrian. Uh-huh. Those were the risks. Like I guarantee you, if you went and looked right now on the U.S. State Department website Turkey.
No, Turkey was said don't go there.
Totally different, right? And that was just a couple of years. So I don't know. I think you're right to look at that for Egypt or anywhere else. We're going to do the same for where we travel. But, you know, you're right. It's like in life, it's like the risk reward. You know, mm-hmm. How many times are you going to get the opportunity to go to Egypt?
Right.
Which is a place I'd love to go.
Right.
As well. And it's not on our itinerary this time, but, you know, and how much riskier is it than places that you could go here? I mean, right. I went to New York City, three times in the last 2 years after right. not going for many years. We brought our family, had a great time. It was awesome. I felt totally safe, you know,
right.
but, you know, there could be something and that happens there.
Kind of what I've been telling myself. And certainly something has happened there, you know, and then, you know, going to New York doesn't make me nervous. I'm from New York, but there have been terrorist attacks there, including some enormous ones, you know, mm-hmm. and like, there was just a big attack in Berlin, but we're going there and I don't right. feel nervous about it. And there was obviously a huge one in Paris and we're going there and I don't feel nervous about it. So to some degree, you just have to accept that you're not going to live in fear.
Right.
While balancing an appropriate amount of sort of caution.
Well, yeah. And on the flip side, and not to sound too negative or too conservative, but that, you know, when we were in Turkey, and this was pre, you know, what's going on now, we were lulled in a false. I think I would felt safer because I had people who knew the culture and the language. You know, it's hard for me to even fathom what it would be if I didn't. So when I'm traveling in New York, I just have to worry about like not wearing Patriots gear, you know, like a Red Sox gear, and probably not even worry that much. Whereas if you're traveling in Egypt and you don't know the language and other than those who do know English, right? You know, you're especially in a rural area, you potentially stand out, right?
Right.
And so you're outside of your comfort zone. And so if you have somebody who's lived in Egypt for 10 years walking around with you and can speak the language and know the culture, that's a lot better than if you don't. And right. so I don't know what I would do.
Yeah.
It would be a lot different too if it were myself versus with my family.
Right.
So I don't know.
Yeah, it's an ongoing consideration, especially over the last couple of days. We've been talking about it a lot more as the departure date nears.
Which you said it was
the 26th
is
when we're starting the trip. So, and I paid a little extra for the cancel for any reason travel insurance. So ultimately, if we did decide not to go, we wouldn't be totally screwed financially. But, you know, it's a big decision. And I think either way, hopefully we'll be able to make the best of it.
I'm sure you will. And yeah. I'm sure you'll have a wonderful time and you deserve it and have a wonderful trip and congratulations on all the wonderful things that are happening to you and have happened to you. And like we were talking about before we got going, the 2016 being a challenging year. Globally,
the weird
versus for you personally,
combination of and even just the last couple of months specifically, mm-hmm. you know, from the excitement kind of started in July. We got engaged, and then we bought the house, and then we moved, and then you know the election was the week we moved in to the new house. You know?
Oh wow!
So it was a lot of very weird mixture of. Very good things happening to us while very bad things were happening all around us, you know? So, it's funny how that works. And that there was this whole, narrative, I guess, of sort of like, thank God 2016 is coming to an end. You know, it's like, well, I don't know. I mean, 2017 sounds like it's going to start pretty rocky as well.
Yeah, right. It already has.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I hear you. You know, it's funny, those like years and they're markers, right? They're mm-hmm. artificial in a way. It's like, you know, but I suppose people use certain occasions to make points. But nonetheless, Yeah, I certainly hope things take a better turn. And don't you feel like helpless? Don't you want to do something to make it all better? And it's just, you know, I do feel like working for Star in a very small way, you can do something to like help a place, maybe inspire some people to go off and make the world a better place, as cheesy as it sounds. So
you know,
in a way I feel like I'm have some outlet for contributing. You know, but it just feel helpless. And, you know, it's like I have we were talking about phones earlier. I have the news feed, you know, on my thing, and I pick all my websites that are the news sites, and I start looking at it. It's just worse than when I used to have cable TV and watch cable news.
Right.
Because it's like you're just saying, oh, that happened. And other than like, I mean, I have the sports feed, thank God, because that's the only thing, it's the only thing that counteracts. You know, the 12 bad stories, for maybe there might be one, you know, quote, the token uplifting story.
It's yeah.
Just, you know, I, you know, we just need everyone to hope and try to make the world a better place. And, you know,
I mean, my former coworkers at the music hall will tell you that every year when I got back, well, my kind of one of my roles in the development office at the music hall was to kind of be the guy who would like poke holes in ideas, you know, and I would be afraid that I was being Debbie Downer, but they called me the voice of reason, you know, so they would come up with ideas and then they'd say, Pete, why is this a bad idea? You know? And I kind of liked being that critical thinking, you know, that I liked taking that perspective, but I did also find that I would somehow always think of everything as a bad idea right off the bat. And I would come home every year from my week on Star Island and I would be positive Pete.
Right.
And they would say, what did they do to you out there? You know, cause I would think everything was a great idea and I'm like, yeah, let's try it. You know?
well, that's good.
Yeah. And so in that way, having a place to refresh and recharge and get away from that constant barrage of negative input and to be in a place where people are really cooperating and sort of being kind and sharing kind of all the time. It feels great, you know, and it really does make a difference, even if it only lasts a week or two, and then you get back into your normal day-to-day drudgery. It can really help.
Well, and you know, I think it's also, I'm glad to hear that's your experience there. And it's certainly been mine. I think it's also, you know, you were mentioning being I forget the nickname, but you were the guy who reasoned that who would like find the holes in things.
Yeah.
And you know, I suppose it is easy to lose perspective when you're doing that and eventually become somebody who's overly critical or glass half empty. I suppose there's a danger, but it's not finding challenges with things or like trying to make things better or being critical that bothers me. I think it's the fact that everyone like yells at each other or cuts each other off, or it's not civil. There's not civil discourse.
Right.
You know, and I, you know, I don't know if I'm falling into this trap of having fond memories of the past, like, oh, it was so much better back then.
Right.
But I feel like even when there was disagreement, I grew up in New Hampshire and I like politically, I just feel like there was less like raw sort of anger and like, I'm not even talking about New Hampshire politics today. I'm just saying in general, like the compared to like what you see and, you know, again, the technology that, brings us some strength also brings us this 24/7 cycle of like people, you know, the clips you go in that alleged news feed I was talking about, you open it up and they have like clips of, you know, people arguing and that's the news.
Yeah.
Like, ooh, see how such and such thing went after so-and-so's.
Right. Well, and let me take the left perspective and let me take the right perspective because inherently they have to be opposite, you know, like what would it take for us to actually agree on something? You know, and why is that so impossible? You know?
Right. I agree. So there has to be a reset with somehow, And I think it probably the best place. So STAR is an example because the best way that can happen is probably locally. You know, you'd imagine the more local where people can actually interact directly and get to know one another and talk about things. And then hopefully that, and you know, it sounds cheesy, but it's education. It's, you know, how are our schools and how are we here, say in this country. But beyond that, I don't know. It's a little overwhelming to think about how to get to a place that's going to be better.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Because it doesn't feel like we're headed in the direction that it would take to get better, you know? And it's a depressing thought to think that the best case scenario of this moment in history is that it's rock bottom. Mm. Like that this is the moment that inspires us to turn around and improve in our civil discourse and to learn from our mistakes and to, the positive spin on this moment is that it can't get worse, you know? But it can.
Right.
And I hope it doesn't.
Right.
But I guess the best case scenario all the time is that you will learn from history and seek to improve. But it's hard to picture right now.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, it's something that will take time over time. And learning about others is the way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And and what better way to learn about others than to be trapped on an island with them and forced to do everything together.
Right, right. In an apolitical way. It's usually apolitical setting, you know, and I think that's why. So you're not being teed up as left versus right or whatever. I mean, I think, probably people make assumptions, but generally speaking, you're just there, and whatever the issues are, you know, people are just having fun and interacting. And when a conflict comes up, you address it in a civil way. It's kind of like that's encouraging. It makes me feel like that in human nature is to try to work through things in a positive way.
Yeah,
I could be wrong about that, but that's what it seems to generally be the case. And that the these things spin out of control when sort of almost provoked. You know, by, these clips of people yelling. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway. Maybe Congress and the Senate should be forced to come to Star Island.
I think
no cameras allowed, no currency allowed, you know.
I think that would be wonderful. And, we have had some politicians come out for R&R with exactly that. And interacting with them is much different than I would have imagined.
Right.
They're people, they're civilians, they're not engaged and they're just doing their thing. And, you know, it does make you wonder how much they're performing when they're in front of a camera.
Yeah.
And so I think you're right. If you could just have everyone come to Star Island, that would be an interesting thing. And, you know, the next session of Congress, they all come together and they sit down. They try to say, so here are the things that we're dealing with. Let's come up with some solutions. And there were no cameras. And there were, you know, I bet it probably would be a major improvement.
Turn the cameras off and make them wear vacation clothes. Yeah. You can't get too mad at somebody who's wearing flip flops.
I agree. Yeah.
Anyway. Okay, so I'll ask you one. I sometimes do like a lightning round, but I want to be sensitive of your time, so I'm just going to do the one big final lightning round question.
Dun, dun, dun.
If you could do one thing every day forever, what would it be?
Whoa! This is one of those questions where. I want like a month to prepare. I'll come back to you with the thing that first came to my mind. So, and I think maybe even after a month would still be in the top three, would be gaming.
Huh.
One way or another, playing a game would probably, that was my initial sort of, you said lightning round. So, and I think the reason for that is, and when I say that, I don't mean video gaming.
Right.
So just to be clear, I mean, interacting with people playing a game. I like role playing games, because they're collaborative, they're creative. And there's some really awesome board games over the last, you know, whatever, decade or so. This is no more Monopolies in life. This is a lot of these games that have come out. Like, I think Settlers of Catan sort of started it. And
yeah.
There's been all these awesome games. To me, playing, I think if I had to pick something quickly, I think gaming would be it. Because it automatically has the following components in my mind. Positive social interaction with people you care for. And fun. So
yeah,
that's my answer.
How has gaming influenced the rest of your life and especially your work?
Well, that's, I think that probably more in general, probably more role playing games or games. And for those who aren't familiar, it's like games that where you're playing a role or a character, I think is, it's something I encourage my children to do because we were talking about the other, I mean, in a silly way, you really are getting to know, or you're trying to, put yourself in somebody else's shoes and then eventually become comfortable in that. Mm. So it's a confidence building, tool, I think, you know, when you're running one of those games, you're doing a lot of planning and thinking through and trying to predict, how people might, interact. Of course, which is always unpredictable. So you also have to be able to roll with things. So you might plan something out in a game and then people go, the players go in a different direction and then you have to be able to adapt on the fly, and not get stuck in a particular avenue. So I think being able to think on the fly, being able to be comfortable with different outcomes. There's several things: imagination, creativity, humor, certainly. These things. Vocabulary. When Gary Gygax died, who is the founder of Dungeons and Dragons, they did a spot on NPR that was so long, and it was an interview of all these famous lawyers and doctors and all these people have gone on to at least traditionally have success and the traditional definition of success. And they were giving these sort of attesting how wonderful Dungeons and Dragons had been in their career development and all the reasons why. So, you know, I really do believe that. You know, it sounds very cheesy to say, but I have to say that, role-playing is something that not only probably helped me in several different ways, writing, I mean, the list goes on and on.
Yeah.
So I think that it helped me in several ways, in all of the jobs I've had. But I think I would highly recommend it to everybody because I think it probably has a universal application, and hence it was the first thing that came to mind.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, seeing things from other people's perspectives, being empathetic, being a good listener. Improvising, you know,
and it's collaborative. The other point is most of the games I played as a kid were competitive, you know, like Monopoly. I love Monopoly. So it's like I was trying to win and I never really liked, I didn't want to cheat, you know, so I didn't, it was like, but
well, you're just limited too strictly by,
well, had I known then that in real life, people cheat at Monopoly, maybe I would have cheated. But the point is you're trying to drive a deal and it's at your gain at the other person's expense, or at least you think it is.
Right.
Whereas role playing generally is everybody's trying to work on the same side, even with different opinions, to come to, you know, to win or to solve the, you know, the next chapter. So that's a big part of it. That's really positive is for me. And something that could translate into anyone's professional or personal success.
Okay. Two follow-up questions based on gaming, because it came up. One is, have you seen the Netflix series, Stranger Things?
Yes, I have, as a matter of fact. And, what happened was I didn't have Netflix and a bunch of friends said, "Oh my God, you have to watch
this show."
And about the fifth time that happened, I was like, okay, I will. And so I got the free, Netflix. Hey, good for Netflix. I'm still a Netflix customer.
Hey,
so
it worked.
But I went and I got it and watched the first one and then debated whether it was too much for my kids or not and decided that they could go for it.
Yeah.
So we watched Stranger Things as a family. I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved it. And I loved it from the first scene because that reminded me of myself when I was a kid.
Totally.
Of course, I didn't go to... Well, I'm not going to... No spoiler alerts. I mean, no... Yeah. But I that reminded me of... I just thought it was so accurate for that era.
It's
and it really spoke to me because I was probably that same age or around whatever it was, 83.
Right.
You know, playing Dungeons and Dragons in a basement. That was like me. You know, so that resonated. But beyond that, I thought it was just a great show. It's my kind of science fiction fantasy, and it's not too gory, not too gross, but
sufficiently scary without being disgusting.
Oh, yeah. I was the one who screamed more than anyone else in my family, but we loved it. And we're looking forward to season two. So.
Okay, final question.
Sure.
Are you aware of and have you ever participated in LARPing?
I'm definitely aware of LARPing.
Live action role playing.
Live action role playing. And I think it is the kind of thing that truly would be a retirement activity for me. I would love to do one thing I never did was go to the big gaming conventions or dress up as like whatever. And keep in mind, when I was growing up, it was not cool to play Dungeons and Dragons.
Right.
So like I played baseball and like I definitely held that part up compared to, you know, my fantasy role playing side. Like
that was baseball and, was your beard.
That was, yes, exactly. So I was in that case and like, and I'm not that I'm proud of that, but that's just the way it was. These days it's like cool to like be into fantasy things. Like, I mean, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, all these things came about and, you know, there's a whole generation, actually more than one generation now, people who love these things. So I think it would have been hard for me as a teenager unless I had unlimited financial resources, I could fly to Arizona and participate. So the short answer is, yes, I'm familiar with it. B, I really admire people who have in the past had the guts to do it, and C, I have once. I have, but it was not what you might think. It was essentially of a Call of Cthulhu, which is a horror role-playing game that's set based on the works of H.P. Lovecraft, and it's set in the real world.
Uh-huh.
So I played this game with a friend of mine who lived at the time in Kentucky, and it was called the Maysville Mystery, and there was about 15 of us flew down and participated in this basically three-day LARPing session, and we all were in character, but we weren't dressed up like an elven, magic user or something. But having said that, this guy, a friend from Star Island, was, did a really good job and had all sorts of people. The town was connected. It was a small town, like, and you never knew who was in on it and who wasn't. So I was having a conversation with the mayor of this town about, and I started asking if he had heard about it. We're ghost hunters trying to find out. And so I was asking him questions like, no, I don't know anything about ghosts. He's like, but I know about voodoo. And I was like, what? And I take out my my notebook and I start writing things down. And turns out later he wasn't in on it. He was just there at the restaurant and he really had a story about it. So it was a great, it was a really well done one and done. It's the only time I ever did it. And it was many years ago. And, we talked about doing one on Star Island, so maybe someday. I know some people who would love to, but it's a lot of work. But to do Star Island might be the best possible venue for a historic sort of murder mystery type.
Oh, totally.
Thing. So maybe that's coming.
I would absolutely like to see that happen.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
It might be too much to be CEO and a conference chair at the same time, but I feel like it would be the natural, beautiful collision of your life's passions.
It would be fun. So maybe post CEO, I'll still always be involved with Star Island. So I've thought about that. Or maybe I'll just be a player, but not in the game necessarily, but making sure the venue is ready to go for others. So
this would be too painful to see it happening and not get to participate.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless I was behind the scenes sort of, unless it was
a
in
plant.
On it. Yes, yes. Anyway.
Cool. Perfect. Okay. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you. This was great. This is my first podcast and it's a privilege and Thank you for inviting me.
You seem like a seasoned professional.
Well, I don't know. Thank you.